Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. Today we're checking in on California's Reparations Task Force. Here's to conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. California is budgeting $12 million for reparations.
This is the first time we're going to have in the state budget, any state budget in this country, a line item for reparations for the descendants of enslaved people here in the country.
We'll talk about how the money may be used and what the complicated process of eligibility could look like. That's ahead on Midday Edition. Years ago, California became the first state in the nation to form a reparations task force. Now the state has officially set aside $12 million for descendants of people who were enslaved under the United States race-based system of chattel slavery. Right now, the California Legislative Black Caucus is on a statewide tour to promote its slate of 14 reparations bills. So on today's show, we're talking about the bills, the funding, and what this means in context of the nation. Emmanuel Felton covers race and ethnicity for The Washington Post. Emmanuel, welcome to Midday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So glad you're here. So first, how does California plan to use the $12 million set aside? I mean, what's the intention there?
So we don't know yet. So what we know is there are about 14 bills working their way through the legislature that address this idea of reparations. None involve direct payments. Some are, you know, efforts to pump money into communities where there's a lot of violence, or to, you know, tackle some school equity issues or topics like that, or to start the agency that would actually run the reparations program. So we don't know what the first $12 million is for. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what the state task force recommended, which was essentially hundreds of billions of dollars. But the question is, how do we get started in a time where there is just very little money in the budget. And that's what lawmakers were facing this session.
Wow. What kind of a shortfall are they looking at?
There was at some point a $50 billion shortfall, right? And I can't remember where it ended up, but it was in the hundreds or tens of billions, right? And so California had a big hole to fill this year. And that was a very tough year for even reparations proponents to have their first go. You know, the question has always been, can we afford this? And so to go out in a year, one of the worst years in budgetary, you know, recent memory, was really a challenge for advocates of reparations. And I think, you know, there are some who were really, toward the beginning of the session, upset that there were no direct cash payments. But I think once they got in, once they saw how bad the budget was, they realized that, hey, this isn't going to be the year we get everything we want. We just have to start, you know, chipping away at this grand project. And, you know, I think there are folks who have always said reparations just means cash payments. And I've talked to those folks, and some of them are even like, well, you know what, this is historic in itself. This is the first time we're going to have in the state budget, any state budget in this country, a line item for reparations for the descendants of enslaved people here in the country.
Yeah. Well, you know, no matter what reparations will actually look like, I mean, I know that's still to be determined, but who would be eligible and how would that part be determined?
Yeah, so that's been a big fight everywhere. What the indecision in California was, if you could trace your lineage back to a person who was either enslaved in this country or a free person of color in this country before 1900, you would qualify for California's reparations programs. That's not set in stone. That was the task force recommendation, and that's been a really thorny, that's been a thorny conversation. You know, made more complicated by the fact that in California, there was very limited. Some Southerners brought their slaves to the state, but California was essentially a free state. There was very limited slavery in the state. And so in California, we're not necessarily talking about slavery, right? We're talking about Jim Crow. We're talking about the decades of things that came after slavery that were sort of remnants of that institution, other institutions that held Black people back. And so the question is, why end it at 1900? Should we end it at 1960? Or should it be all Black folks, including more recent immigrants from Africa and the Caribbean? And that has been the fight across the country. But, you know, California decided to limit it to people who can trace their ancestry back to a Black person who was in this country before 1900.
And California has been leading the nation in a lot of these reparations efforts. Do you think other states and the nation as a whole may follow California's lead at some point?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? I think, you know, there are definitely people who are interested. Here in New York, there's a task force that's launching. Illinois, there's a task force. New Jersey, there's a task force. There's city task force across the country. You know, in fact, the first people to pay out reparations is a town called Evanston, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. And they're paying out reparations for their discriminatory housing segregation policies from 1919 to 1969. And so in that case, it's a little complicated, but essentially people who trace their lineage back to people who were in Black folks who were in Evanston at that time qualified for $25,000 with some exceptions. But that's generally the way the program works. And so, you know, Evanston's the first to pay, but California is by far like years ahead of other states. But the question is, does this turn into a real reparations program? And that's still up in the air. I mean, you know, there's some thought that, you know, California is the progressive beacon in this country and leads the way. But it's also a state where only 5% of the population is Black, right? So, you know, the Black population doesn't have the same electoral power that they do back east, right? And so the question is, in California, can you convince Latinos and Asians voters and politicians who don't necessarily have the same connection to this history, you know, that they should pay for the sort of maybe the founding sins of California's white founding fathers?
Have you gotten taken the temperature on that?
Yeah, I mean, so what we've seen in both our own polling and polling done by UC Berkeley and some other folks who've polled just in California is that Latino and Asian voters are definitely more interested or more open to the idea of reparations than white voters, but are still on the whole against the idea of cash payments for Black or for Black residents. So it's definitely still a hurdle. And, you know, some of the most vocal opponents of reparations this year in Sacramento have been Latino and, well, particularly some Latino Republican assembly members who and state senators who have said, you know, it's just not fair. We weren't the, you know, our ancestors aren't the people who made these policies. Why should we pay now?
Well, what's been the rebuttal to that, if any?
Yeah, I think, you know, the answer that I hear from advocates, it's like, well, when you come to this country, when you assume, you know, when you start making a living based on this country's greatness and on its, you know, its prosperity, that prosperity was built on the backs of enslaved Black people. And that, you know, any American, every American owes something to those people is usually the rebuttal.
Okay. Well, how does the Legislative Black Caucus fit into all of this? And what role does the California Task Force play?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, the task force is pretty much done. It's disbanded. You know, some of the folks who were involved are still, you know, I would say almost all of them are still out there trying to rally support for reparations in different ways. You know, The conversation has really been among former task members that I talked to is how do we sell this to voters? How do we sell this to everyday Californians? Because that's going to be the hard part moving forward. I think, you know, you can find ways to find $12 million in the budget of a state with a $300 billion budget. But when we talk about doing something much grander than that, you're going to need widespread support. And so whether it's public information campaigns or advocacy, that's really where I've been hearing the former task force members are focusing. Whereas, you know, they're doing that with members of the Black Caucus, right? And you see people like Senator Bradford really leading the charge. You know, this is his last hurrah. And I think like this is one of the things that he wants to see as part of his legacy as he's looking at retiring later this year. So I think there are a lot of people who are out there traveling the state, really working hard on this issue, but it's a big one. This is California's venturing into territory that no one else has really. And I think the question for the nation has been like, you know, what is success? What's possible? And a state as progressive as California will really be the benchmark moving forward.
So reparations have been long discussed at the federal level, but with no movement there. Why are we seeing momentum now with California's initiative, you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, California, I think a lot of it comes down to timing. I think, you know, advocates there were able to get Governor Newsom to sign a bill right in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, right? So there is this momentum at that moment. So we get a task force, and that task force does this amazing job, right? They produce this 1,100-page report that isn't a true indictment on California. It's not about the federal system. It's about how California specifically, its state government, its city governments, not only failed Black people, but actively held them back in many sectors of society. And so now we have this 1,100-page report. We have this manifesto, essentially. And so California is ahead of the game because, you know, their task force got up and running at a time where there was a lot more political will behind the idea of solving the racial wealth gap and the sort of the really the intractable racial injustices we see in this country. And, you know, sadly, I think with everything in politics, there's a pendulum swing and we've swung away from that fervor we had in the days and months after George Floyd. So that set California up to tackle this issue in a way that no other state did. The question is, now we're getting to money. And we're getting to money at a time where there's both a budget shortfall and we've seen less political will to tackle these issues of racial injustice in the country.
Yeah. You know, earlier you mentioned, you know, the big question of how will lawmakers sell this idea of reparations. From where you sit, do you have any ideas on that? I mean, how have other groups been able to achieve that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I mean, you know, the Japanese American community did get reparations in the 1980s, but that came after a battle that started in the 70s. It was a long generational fight to get public support. And really at that point, a federal support, federal politicians behind the idea that this is something that had to be done to rectify what happened during the war with internment camps. So it's always been, you know, getting the government to move is always a slow process, especially on something this big. And so I think, you know, I think for reparations advocates, this is the long slog. This is, you know, the arguments are out there. And now it's about convincing Americans to do what they think is the right thing to do.
Well, yeah. Where do the reparations efforts in California go from here then?
I think, you know, we'll see what happens with the 14 bills. We'll see what happens with the 12 million. And then, you know, there'll be another legislative session. And it'll just, you know, this is, I think advocates are prepared for a multi-year, maybe a really generational battle to make this happen.
I've been speaking with Emmanuel Felton, race and ethnicity reporter with The Washington Post. Emmanuel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll hear from the former chair of California's Reparations Task Force.
Because of slavery, right? No, actually, we were the financial instruments. We were the property given to people.
Hear more when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Black Californians with family members who were formerly enslaved are a few steps closer to seeing redress for the atrocities of chattel slavery and social injustice. We just talked about what reparations in California mean in the greater context of the U.S. Now we'll find out where efforts stand in the state. For 2 years, the California Reparations Task Force was charged with collecting the data and hearing from people with lived experience to form recommendations for reparations in the state. While the task force is now disbanded, the work of members is far from over. Camila Moore was chair of the California Reparations Task Force. She joins us now. Camila, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. So California recently allocated $12 million for reparations to help fix systems and policies born out of the legacy of chattel slavery. What does that mean to the task force?
Well, in terms of the final report from the task force, or really our modus operandi, like the thesis of our final report, we found that under the 13th Amendment, Section 2 in particular of the 13th Amendment, it actually empowers Congress, or actually should compel Congress to, what we said, eradicate any lingering badges and incidents of slavery that still persist in this state. In this society. And that responsibility not only, is reserved to Congress, but to state legislatures as well. Essentially, in terms of, the work of the 2 years of the task force, the first year was the study phase, where we were studying the various different atrocities or those lingering badges and incidents of slavery that we identified. We identified 12 major areas of systemic discrimination or lingering badges and incidents of slavery that disproportionately impact descendants of American slaves, from, racial terror. So we look at a historical lens of these badges and incidents of slavery, but we also included, right, contemporary data as well to show that this, these badges and incidents of slavery still persist. So, from racial terror to political disenfranchisement to racism in the environment and infrastructure, mental and physical harm and neglect, the wealth gap, those are just some of the major areas of systemic discrimination that the task force identified and pretty much stated that there should be, comprehensive policy that should be enacted to address these problems. And so just to conclude, the task force, we recommended over 115 policy recommendations over the last year of our work, based on everything that we learned and studied in the first year of our work. That's essentially what it means to the task force. Our task was to, again, not only study, but to also develop, comprehensive reparation proposals for this particular population, this particular group of people.
Yeah. Well, how are you feeling about it? And is $12 million enough?
Yes. So heard recent news, that in this next year's budget, California's next year's budget for 2024 to 2025, there has been $12 million allocated for what would be considered reparations implementation funding. So that $12 million would be reserved for, funding, whatever reparations legislation passes through the legislature this summer. And then is signed by Governor Newsom, by his deadline of September 30th, whatever those bills are, that $12 million allocation would be reserved to implementing those particular bills. And so I think it's a great step in the right direction for many reasons. On its face, yes, it does not seem like enough. But at the same time, the fact that the government, the state, is reserving money to reparations, right? It's unprecedented. And it's showing that the state is at least willing to acknowledge the harm done by their own policies, by their own actions or even omissions to this particular population. And so, this $12 million essentially is kind of like a seed, right, of good faith. And it's for helping to get the infrastructure, kind of building up that infrastructure for what I see and what I envision to be more stronger and substantive reparations legislation in future legislative sessions.
And the Legislative Black Caucus recently started their statewide tour here in San Diego, promoting 14 bills that would help to build that infrastructure you're talking about. Can you tell me about a few of those bills that stick out to you and why they hold so much importance?
Sure, absolutely. One of the bills, for instance, and all of these bills are in one way or another, again, are rooted in the task force's final report and our recommendations. One of them is ACA 8, which is a constitutional amendment. It passed through the state legislature. And since it's a constitutional amendment, it's going to be on the ballot this upcoming November for voters to decide. And that bill would, amend the California Constitution to no longer allow, on its face, slavery or involuntary servitude in prisons, in California state prisons. Another bill is SB 1050, introduced by State Senator Stephen Bradford, but it's a part of the COBC's priority package. That would allow for, land restitution. So really a direct benefit to descendants or to families who have been directly impacted by unjust property taking. So let's say, you were, the government took your land via a racially motivated for eminent domain. In that situation, you would be provided, land restitution. So either you could, get compensation for that unjust property taking, or in some instances, that land could be conveyed back to you. And that's similar to what happened when LA County a couple of years ago, conveyed land back to the descendants of the Bruce couple who owned a beach town resort in Manhattan Beach. And it was taken away by the government via racially motivated eminent domain. And so that's another bill.
From your perspective, is there anything else that should be taking priority at this point? I know the task force had many recommendations. Some are taking priority now, some aren't. What do you think should be added to that list?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you. And I was, I would say definitely two bills by Senator Stephen Bradford that have been making incredible progress through the state legislature and are just two steps away from being on Governor Newsom's desk. One of them is Senate Bill 1403, and that would create a new state agency for descendants of American slaves. That office would contain, a legal counsel, a secretary, and for now, a genealogy office as well. Those would be the three primary offices. That genealogy office, for instance, would be tasked with, assisting people with their claims and making sure that they're, eligible, but long term, right? This agency would, facilitate different, reparations programs and policies, and provide oversight to existing state agencies as well, on issues concerning this population. And then another bill is SB 1331, and that would create a new account in the state treasury, in California's treasury, to fund, reparations policies and programs for descendants of American slaves as well. So for instance, those two bills, they actually passed the state Senate, and now they're on the assembly side. I think the next hearing is August 15th at the assembly suspense file. That's the process whereby, know, bills go that, you know, have a certain amount of funding attached to it. And then once it passes through that process, it goes to the state assembly floor for a vote and then to Governor Newsom's desk. So I would definitely say to keep an eye out on those two bills for sure.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, on that office that you mentioned that would help people with their genealogy, what did you all settle on in terms of eligibility requirements and how it would work?
So the task force, in terms of the community of eligibility, we defined it as a group would be, you know, those who are, you know, descendants of a free or an enslaved Black person living in the United States prior to 1900. And, you know, that it took a lot of debate and conversation to get to that point. You know, over 10 months of the first year of our work was really kind of embroiled on this question, but we settled it through a majority vote that the community of eligibility would be, you know, what we are calling lineage-based rather than race-based, which is important for a couple of reasons, but particularly from a legal perspective, whereby, you know, we live in a state like California that we learned through our expert testimony has even been called a don't say Black state because, you know, race-based affirmative action has been illegal, per se, in this state since 1996 with, you know, the passing of Proposition 209, the passage of that constitutional amendment that, you know, prohibits race-based considerations in the areas of contracting, education, and employment.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know that the undertaking, right, of like tracing family roots can be really intensive. And so to put that process into perspective, I want to talk about what chattel slavery is for those who don't quite understand its meaning, and specifically how it may impact one's ability to trace back family history. Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that's something that we also talked about in terms of our report. You know, the first chapter in our report is on enslavement. And then the 12 remaining chapters are on those badges and incidents of slavery that I mentioned. But, you know, in our enslavement chapter, we describe, you know, essentially what chattel slavery is, you know, and essentially before I get to describing it, it was important to describe because a lot of people who are against reparations, you even have very influential people like Elon Musk, right, saying something like this to Don Lemon in an interview recently where he said, oh, we were all slaves or we all came from slaves at one point in time and one, you know, in history. But that's really, it's kind of ignorant of the real truth to what chattel slavery, you know, was, right? And how it was practiced in the United States in particular, where, you know, essentially human beings were relegated to be financial instruments, to be considered chattelized property. And it was hereditary. Like, so those elements together made the system of slavery in the United States unique, right? Practiced in a way that's never been done before. In many other societies where there was slavery, you know, it wasn't hereditary in any sense. It wasn't codified into law, right? That if you were a slave and you were born to a mother who was enslaved, right? Essentially to a Black woman, right? You would be enslaved for the rest of your life. And that status would be, you know, passed down to your children, right? That made, you know, a slavery in this country particularly unique, right? When you think about, for instance, wills and trusts, right? In many instances, you know, we could have been the beneficiaries of certain wealth passed down by these enslavers. But because of slavery, right? No, actually, we were the financial instruments. We were the property given, right, to people, just to kind of illustrate, you know, what that means. We understand that there's many different challenges to this work in terms of eligibility, but that burden of proof should not be on, right, the community. It should not be on descendants. And so that's why, right, SB 1403, that would create this new state agency with a genealogy office, is so important because it transfers a burden of proof, essentially, from the community to the state. And it would be the state funding those expert genealogists, some of these expert genealogists, to assist people in that work, right? Taking that burden from them. So I'm really looking forward to that, you know, if and hopefully when it passes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, given that and given all of the hard work that the task force put into this, how does it feel to start to see your work materialize here?
It's a great feeling. You know, this was a labor of love, as I mentioned earlier. You know, this was purely on a volunteer basis, and I personally made a lot of sacrifices to serve on this commission. And, you know, it's a wonderful feeling, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be a part of what I consider, you know, this to be a very sacred political project. You know, not only, you know, standing in the shoes of my ancestors to help, you know, achieve justice for them, but to also solve some, you know, various serious problems that are still plaguing communities today.
I've been speaking with Camila Moore. She chaired the California Reparations Task Force. Camila, thank you as always.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
Coming up, a genealogist walks us through the process of tracing the ancestry of descendants of enslaved people.
Records weren't kept very well on enslaved people. Enslavers actually did keep records, but what those records look like vary per enslaver, per plantation.
More to come when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Bilhau Plumbing, Heating, and Air Restoration and Flood Services. Family-owned and operated over 4 decades, Bilhau has been serving the plumbing, heating, and air, and water damage needs of the San Diego area since 1980. With their fleet of trained professionals, Bilhau has the ability to service all major and minor plumbing and HVAC emergency needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bilhau is committed to providing excellent service to their customers with transparent quotes and attention to detail on every job. Whether you're in need of an HVAC installation, plumbing, or water damage restoration in San Diego, they offer the convenience of scheduling an appointment over the phone, online, or through live chat on their website. Call 1-800-BILHOW or visit bilhau.com, because we know how.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Reparations efforts in California are still moving along and now have some funding and bills in progress to solidify what that may entail. We just heard some of the details from Camila Moore, chair of the California Reparations Task Force. Now let's look into what it could take to prove eligibility for cash payments and some of the challenges of that process. Adrienne Abiodun is a professional genealogist with Legacy Tree Genealogy. She's been in the field for 15 years. Adrienne, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, glad to have you here. So for those who don't know, what is a genealogist?
A genealogist is someone who is either by hobby or profession, they engage in the search for family. They construct family trees, they put pedigrees together and lineage, and they are invested in it, just researching and extending the family. They could be someone who is working on biographical information for family. So there's many, many things, many hats a genealogist can wear, but it's all about family history and lineage.
And how does that fit into this larger conversation about reparations?
So as I understand it, it fits in because California has decided that they are going to take a lineage-based approach to proving descendants of formerly enslaved people. And a lineage-based approach would require genealogy. That would be a traditional genealogy effort where you're using records and documents to trace family histories. Or it could also involve DNA. It really depends on what they decide is going to be their requirements for proving that lineage.
Well, during chattel slavery, Black families were often broken up. Children were separated from their parents and sold off. Partners, siblings, and grandparents all sold off. I imagine that makes tracing family roots difficult. Can you talk about some of the challenges you encounter doing this work?
You're so right about that. African-American people, Black American people, they don't have the easiest time tracing their family histories because of the impact of being a descendant of a formerly enslaved group of people. And records weren't kept very well on enslaved people. There is a truth and a lie to that part. Enslavers actually did keep records, but what those records look like vary per enslaver, per plantation. Some enslavers were small enslavers and maybe only had one or two individuals that they enslaved. So when we're talking about records, usually people are talking about census records and how, in particular, 1850, 1860, they did not record African-American people by name. Either they were included on a slave census or a slave schedule that detailed them by their sex, age, and the plantation owner. But if you dig deeper, yes, you can find records on enslaved people. It's usually those wills and probate records and court cases and some newspaper articles and things like that, where you're really digging to find the names of formerly enslaved people.
And so, I mean, how do you navigate those challenges? Because I would imagine in some of those records, there are no names. It may just be child, age 5, you know, something like that. And then not to mention the last name, once a person was sold, was changed to a different name altogether. So how does that work?
It's very complicated. That's how it works. And I think what I'm interested in this whole reparations and lineage-based approach is who's going to vet the research, who's going to conduct this level of research. It's not a weekend activity per se. This could take several of years for a person to research their family history, decades even. Yes, there have been advancements that make it easier. Records have been digitized. They're available online. You don't have to go to courthouses and such. But there are still hurdles that are going to be very hard to overcome. So it's going to look very different from family to family. But I think what people need to have is going to be patience with this. If you're talking about starting with a person today, and they have to prove their parents and their grandparents and then their great grandparents, and maybe they only have to go to their second great grandparents until they get to an enslaved person, or maybe their great grandparents. The records are going to be outside of California. They're going to be in southern states. They're going to need to have money to collect those vital records, birth, marriage, and death records, if they exist. And you're right, things like name changes. Name changes did not just occur right after the period of enslavement. They occurred during Jim Crow era. They occurred as people were leaving the southern states and migrating to Chicago and New York and LA for better opportunities. People were leaving to pass in other area. So the African American experience in this country is multifold and very dynamic. And researching one's ancestors, you may not even hit that brick wall at 1870. You might hit that brick wall sooner than that, like at your grandparents.
Wow. Well, while you live in Florida, you and your extended family have a personal stake in what's happening here in California around reparations. And you're also dealing with some of those challenges. Can you tell me about it?
I am in Florida. My mother was born and raised in California, and her siblings still live out there. My first cousins live in Southern California. So my interest is in if there were an eligibility for this as individuals who or a family who can prove that they do descend from formerly enslaved people. I'm just curious about the criteria. And again, what is going to be required for proof and how they're going to, what records are they're going to ask for. So I will say, yes, I can prove that we do come from enslaved people on one line, but there are multiple lines in my mother's family history where we cannot prove we descend from formerly enslaved people. And what that means is I've hit that 1870 brick wall. I've traced my family back to Mississippi. All of my ancestors seem to have come out of Mississippi on all sides, but I traced them as far back as I could there. I have no idea who their enslavers were, if their last names were changed prior to the 1870, or if they were something else or the same last name. I have no idea if they had siblings or were only children. Those are the types of challenges that you touched on a moment ago when you said people were sold and brothers and sisters and parents and children were sold from north to south. And those are the things, if you don't have any knowledge or any kind of family oral history, like where you were raised on hearing these stories and they were passed down, those are the leads that you usually use and need when you start your search in documents. And for me, my search took nearly 10, 15, 20 years to find some of the information that my family has now at its dispense.
You'd mentioned that a lot of the leads come from like the stories that you're told from maybe grandma or grandpa or something. You know, like in my family, and I'm sure in many families, some of our grandparents did not tell those stories because it was so emotionally taxing to relive the trauma. This work seems like it could have a heavy emotional load for you and for the people that you work with. So can you unpack what that's been like?
Yes, and it was the same way for my family. My mother, as I mentioned, and her siblings were all born in California, and their parents had left Mississippi for the purpose of finding better opportunity, escaping the oppressive South, racism, Jim Crow, things of that nature. And my mother and siblings and aunts, uncles did not grow up with an understanding of either of their parents' families because, or grandparents at that, you know, they only knew one grandmother. And they did not ask questions. They were the generation of you don't ask questions because, you know, it wasn't a child's place to ask those types of questions, but also because they were painful. And people wanted to move past that. So I literally have been the one sharing and telling the family about the history as I've gone digging, but it's been years and years because, again, I'm doing this in the reverse. I should have, my mother and my parents, my grandparents should have told me this information, but they did not, and it was not shared. So when you don't have the families that do share that, that's already one challenge you're working with. And then it has been my experience that I find that the people who seem to have a lot of information or know a lot about this or have known about it for many years are the families that, for whatever reason, were like, we're not going to let this information die. This needs to be known. It needs to be retold. But a lot of families didn't have that.
That's true. Well, you mentioned how long this process of sort of digging into your family roots, finding your ancestry can take. Can you tell us how long does it take for the average person to do this?
Oh, that's really going to vary. That's going to vary on a lot of things. One, their ability to understand what it is that they need to, what evidence or information or documents that they need to obtain next. So the ability, the skill, the know-how. It's also going to depend on how fast they want to get it done and whether or not they're able to retrieve certain records from certain repositories. And, you know, if they need a military pension record from the National Archives, what's the wait time on that? It's they don't send those to you in a week. That's, let me give you a hint. Those usually take months. They can take months depending on a backlog or all kinds of things. So the wait time or how long this could take for an individual really varies. You're having to work with repositories. Like I said, the interesting thing about this is that, yes, California's acting as the responsible party for the reparations, but the individuals proving their lineage will have to almost undoubtedly have to interact with other states and their vital record systems to try to obtain birth and marriage and death records if they're using and asking for those type of documents to prove lineage. So southern states where formerly enslaved people came from, they might need records from Arkansas or Tennessee or Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, where their grandparents may have come from or their parents may have come from or great-grandparents may have come from prior to their time in California.
Wow. So this really is a nationwide effort, it sounds like. And right now there is a bill, though, to create a genealogy office for Californians to help people trace their lineage. Outside of that, what other options do people have to find out more about their ancestry?
I think the best thing people could do who are interested in this topic right now would be to start from with the basics from the beginning. You know, reach out to your older relatives, ask them very simple questions. You know, who was your mom and dad, or who is my grandma, my grandfather? You know, get their names, get any nicknames, get any information you can that way. And you know, where were they born? Where did they die? What year were they born, and when did they die? And then collect up that information, and then start to figure out where they need to try to obtain records. Again, I don't know what the proof requirement will be. But most genealogy lineage requirements, like say if you're joining a lineage organization, they usually require the very basics are those vital records: marriage, birth, death. Census records can be a great substitute for that. They usually are. Newspaper articles, obituaries. Just try to collect up any record of information on family that helps to connect each generation, and that shows this person is the parent of this child and so forth.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of California's lineage-based approach? I mean, what are the pros and cons in your eyes?
As a genealogist, I'm probably biased here, but I think the right way to prove you were a descendant of a formerly enslaved person. Otherwise, I'd have a hard time imagining how any government would go about doing so. You know, not all Black or African people of color in this country are descendants of formerly enslaved people. So just as a checks and balances, I think this is a good way to go about it. However, it can be challenging. It will be a hard way. It won't be something I think that everyone will be able to do, or swiftly be able to do at that. So it could take a couple of years to prove your lineage. It could go with assistance. Maybe it could go faster than that. But I have several clients in my own work that I cannot prove their lineage to an enslaved person in 40 hours, 100 hours. Sometimes it takes a lot of time. So I think it's the right thing to do, but I do feel it will be very time intensive.
I've been speaking with professional genealogist Adrian Abiodun. Adrian, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Bilhau Plumbing, Heating, and Air Restoration and Flood Services. Family-owned and operated over 4 decades, Bilhau has been serving the plumbing, heating, and air, and water damage needs of the San Diego area since 1980. With their fleet of trained professionals, Bilhau has the ability to service all major and minor plumbing and HVAC emergency needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bilhau is committed to providing excellent service to their customers with transparent quotes and attention to detail on every job. Whether you're in need of an HVAC installation, plumbing, or water damage restoration in San Diego, they offer the convenience of scheduling an appointment over the phone, online, or through live chat on their website. Call 1-800-BILHOW or visit bilhau.com, because we know how.